Morning or good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are. Welcome to today's webinar on solving test puzzles with policies, strategies, and plans. I am Rex Black, president of RBCS, a worldwide testing and quality assurance firm serving clients ranging from small startups to Fortune 20 global enterprises. Since 1994, we have delivered insight and confidence to hundreds of clients around the world. We have a team of international consultants that deliver customized training, consulting, and expert services for companies that are looking to improve their test and quality assurance practices. I am the author of over a dozen books on software testing, as well as being the past president of the ISTQB. Attendance at today's webinar earns PMI PDUs. Thank you to Vicky Sasser for reviewing the materials for PDU status and for making valuable suggestions. Attendees will receive an email telling them how to claim PDUs, including the PDU code. PDUs are available for live webinar attendance only. If you have any questions during the course of the webinar, you may submit them at any time, but please note that they will be answered at the end. Hope you enjoy this free webinar from RBCS. We do these free webinars as a service to the software testing community because at RBCS we are a not just for profit company. If you enjoy our free webinars and feel that they demonstrate solid insights into the kinds of testing challenges you face, please make RBCS your preferred software testing vendor for any and all expert services, consulting, or training. We're happy to provide a quote for any such help you might need. Contact us at info@rbcs-us.com. Policies, strategies, and plans. These are terms that attract some amount of confusion. Well, hopefully by the end of today, on the end of this hour, you'll have a clear idea of what they are and what purpose they can serve. They do help clarify and answer some very important questions, which I'll get to in just a minute. So these things should not be thought of as like soulless IEEE 829 templates that seem a lot like tax forms and have to get filled out and don't do anything clearly or at least obviously to advance progress, but rather these should be seen as relevant tools that help you understand and communicate about some of the pressing challenges that we face as test professionals. So here are some of the critical questions that don't always get answered, which having policies, strategies, and plans in place can help you answer. So what should testing accomplish? What are you trying to do? Sometimes we get so caught up in the day-to-day, you know, shuffle of work, or maybe it's not a shuffle, it's a frenzy, and the urgent keeps driving out the important, but really, shouldn't we have some idea of what we're trying to accomplish, what our objectives are, and how would we recognize that we were actually successfully accomplishing those? In our personal lives, we do things like set financial goals, say we want to have a certain amount of money in the bank, want to have certain types of personal projects done in a particular point, in a period of time, but not always so good at getting that clear in our testing work. How should we go about doing testing, just in general? What are the sort of patterns of behaviors that will allow us to succeed, the best practices of testing which can be implemented for us? Have we spent time thinking about those, recognizing them? Now, for any given release or project or even iteration, what specifically needs to be done in order to carry out those best practices and accomplish those goals? You can think about that. We also need to think about what could go wrong while we're trying to do that and how we can manage those risks, the things that could happen that would interfere with our ability to carry out our planned testing activities. And all this, of course, happens in a broader context, a software development lifecycle. So what is that lifecycle? And how does that lifecycle affect what you're doing and what you're saying in your policy, strategy, and plans? So these are the puzzle pieces that we're trying to solve with a policy strategy and plans. And we're going to touch on some of these points as we go along today, give you a better idea of what exactly I mean. So the test policy, this is the why we test. It says this is what we're trying to accomplish. What are the overall objectives? And it ideally spans the entire organization. I've worked with some clients to help them institute test policies where, for various reasons, such as significant differences between different entities within the organization, they had to have different policies. But you should generally try to have this defined at the highest level possible for sake of consistency. If it gets to the point where trying to define a uniform policy across multiple groups in the organization becomes too vague or too convoluted, like, well, if this is true, we're trying to do this, but if that's true, we're trying to do that, then, you should feel free to have separate policies. But certainly, if you're down to the point of, for a specific release or specific development project, putting together a test policy for that, that's too low level. This is usually something where at the senior management, executive management level, we're trying to have a communication about what are we trying to accomplish with testing? Why are we doing it? What is its business value? How would we measure whether we were being effective at it? Are we accomplishing those objectives in a sufficient fashion? Efficiency. We're not only accomplishing the objectives in a effective fashion, but are we doing it in a way that is wise with respect to utilization of some resource or resources? What resource do we want to optimize for? Is it time to release? Is it budget? Is it staff hours? So you need to think about that. What does a typical test process look like? We may or may not want to include this in a test policy because this gets into the how, which is more of a strategy, as I'll get to in a minute. But some organizations do like to have some sort of graphical overview of what the typical test process looks like. How do we improve the process over time? Again, this may or may not be something that you want to address in your policy, but you might want to have that in there, especially if that's sort of an organizational thing, is that every type of activity needs to have some provision for how it improves over time. So those last two, maybe you include those, maybe you don't. This should be a short document. Ideally, it's 1-2 pages long. I've seen situations where clients ended up putting together 10 or 15 page policies and you get an issue with people not really reading it. It's remember, what we're trying to do here is communicate to senior test stakeholders, that this is why testing is important. Sometimes you hear this phrase, elevator speech. And basically, that's kind of what your test policy is. It's if you are in an elevator with an executive level person and talking to them about testing and why it matters, what you accomplish, how you measure accomplishment, and so forth, that the test policy is what you would say to that person. This is an example of a anonymized test policy document that I helped a client put together a number of years ago. Not perfect, but it's food for thought. You notice we have a mission statement there. Effectively and efficiently provide timely, accurate, and useful quality risk management information and services. So help the organization manage the risks of quality-related issues to their software and production. We have a brief description of the strategy is primarily a risk-based testing strategy that also includes other elements such as reactive strategies and so forth. We talk about that here, just a brief description. Now, notice that we have a discussion of the different test levels, and the way that the test levels are sequenced is described here, and the ownership of those levels is divvied out. The team that I was working with is the risk mitigation and quality assurance team. That was their name. You notice that unit and integration testing are owned by development, acceptance testing owned by the business. See that? We have defined objectives for each level of testing. And then we have key areas to test, basically test types that need to be covered there. So this is valuable and to use a test policy to provide for coordination of activities across different groups. Of course, you know, there needs to be buy-in here in this case. We have to have the development management and business management bought into this distribution of effort. On this page, you see that we did have a graphic view of the test process as it applies to each level. This is going to give people an idea of, okay, this is what needs to be carried out. And the KPIs, key process indicators, this is where the effectiveness and efficiency metrics were to go. The client continued this work after I was done getting this initial piece in place for them. So they ended up filling in the blanks here. So as you can see, there is still some work to be done. And that is something that needs to be done carefully, this defining of metrics. If it's done badly, it can go quite wrong. Pardon me, a little drink of water there. For those of you who haven't caught it out on the RBCS YouTube channel, which I'll show you the coordinates for later when we get into the Q&A session, I have a recorded webinar called Stupid Metrics Tricks and How to Avoid Them. And there's also a recording of me giving that same presentation as a keynote speech, actually twice, once in Moscow at the Heisenberg Conference and once in Portland, Oregon at the PNSQC Conference. So you can listen to those. The PNSQC presentation of it include the Deming red bead, white bead experiment, which if you've never seen it done is worth a listen. But anyway, that's it. It's just a cautionary tale here about, you know, filling in the blanks on the metrics part of this should not be seen as that's easy. And, you know, just whatever comes shooting out of whatever test management tool or ALM tool or task management tool we're using, that's the metric we're going to use. That's likely not to turn out well. So the policy is the why. What are we trying to accomplish? The strategy is the how. It's a general way that we go about testing from one release to the next. So it should be written as like patterns that we've observed that tend to produce good outcomes from one project to the next. And another name for a pattern that's associated with producing good outcomes is a best practice. So we want to say these are what we find to be best practices for testing in our particular organization. Now, as a consultant working with a lot of different clients, I see patterns of patterns, as it were, patterns in test strategies, kind of common things that I see present in there, and so. Based on that, there's some types of strategies that are identified. These are in the ISTQB foundation syllabus, including the new one, the 2018 one that I just was a project manager for in the first half of this year, and in the advanced test manager and also in the expert test manager. And so these are things that that you can do some further research on if you want to go look at different types of strategies. I also have done a webinar on that of the different types of test strategies and explaining what they are and their strengths and weaknesses, application of them. But the point here being that you should be able to identify of these common types of strategies, multiple strategies that are applicable for your organization, for your projects. And so you should make sure that as you're putting your test strategy in place, you're looking at these common best practices that have been observed by people like me, consultants who work with clients around the world. So things like risk-based testing, requirements-based testing, building models for performance or for functional testing, using reactive techniques, especially in conjunction with things like exploratory testing. So come up with a good blend of strategy types as you're implementing your strategy. Don't leave anything valuable out. Now, your strategy should be tailored to your specific situation. You're dealing with safety critical types of systems. Your strategy has to be tuned to be one that is very, very effective in terms of reducing risk of failure in production, very effective in terms of detecting defects. If there are regulatory requirements, you need to make sure that your strategy addresses those regulatory requirements. Basically, every objective that's laid out in your policy, you should be able to point to elements of your strategy that support accomplishing that objective. If not, you've got a gap in your strategy. And it's true the other way around too, that anything in your strategy, anything that your strategy says, yes, as testing, we do this, and testing, we do that. You should be able to say, we do this because we're trying to accomplish this objective. So that's a good sanity check here to make sure that you're not just documenting stuff for the sake of documenting it. You know, you said in the policy, this is what we're trying to accomplish. Now, here's how we're trying to accomplish it. Now, the issue of documenting it, this can be documented in various ways. I mean, it can be documented in a Word document. It can end up in a PDF. But I have plenty of clients that are doing things like having Confluence pages and wiki pages and so forth. And that's good to have those posted like that. But remember, if you do that, you need to keep track of are people actually referring to them? Okay. So go look at the hit rates on those pages that describe the strategy. And, you know, if nobody's ever looking at it, then you obviously have a relevance issue. Now, what goes in the test strategy document? Well, basically anything that is common and universal across multiple releases is a candidate. How you manage defects, so the whole defect lifecycle, the tools that are used to track the defects, those kinds of things, that's an obvious candidate. Where your test cases or test procedures or whatever you call them, where do those get stored and how do those get tracked? How's the status assigned? Is there other stuff that needs to be managed? Other work products that need to be managed? Data, for example, test data. How is test data produced? Are you using production data? Is it anonymized? If so, how is that anonymization process handled? How are you utilizing test automation? What constitutes a proper confirmation test when you get a bug fix back? How is somebody supposed to do a proper confirmation test? They run just the steps to reproduce the failure from the associated defect report, or do they actually have to run every single test that failed because of that defect as well? What's the level of documentation that's supposed to be gathered for a test case? What constitutes a properly documented test case? What are some examples of test case documentation mistakes, over-documenting or under-documenting? Where are your environments? How do they get used? This is all stuff that tends to be true across multiple releases, and so it's a good candidate. One of the things I did for a client once that didn't have a strategy, they had plans, was I came in and I looked at about a dozen of their plans and I said, you know, guys, you notice how every time when you create a plan, a test plan, you just take a previous project test plan and use that as a template, and like 80% of the stuff you don't change. And they're like, yeah. I said, well, that's your test strategy. That is what belongs in the test strategy, because that stuff doesn't change. So rather than drag that documentation around and have people wading through it over and over again, and they've already seen it before, you know, put it out there in a separate document, a separate repository, what have you. And then there's your strategy. And what goes in your plan then is how you're going to execute on the strategy for a particular release, which I'll get into in a minute. All right, so hopefully that's clear so far. The policy is the why, and the strategy is the how in a general sense, independent of project. And then the plan is the execution of the strategy for a project or release. Now, we'll get into that in a minute, but I want to give you kind of another example out of a test strategy here. It's a little food for thought. I was working with a client, helping them define a test strategy, and they were in a interesting situation that they had, and not an all that unusual situation, where they had a data center, has about 100 applications in it, and those applications are of varying levels of importance, and then they have projects that occur that deal with those applications, and those projects are of varying levels of risk from an organizational point of view. So what they would do at the beginning of a project is do a risk assessment for the project, look at, you know, how bad would it be if we had quality problems with this particular piece of software that we're creating, what have you. So they come up with a rating collectively across project stakeholders and participants of what the overall initial risk is, okay? And then what we said is, okay, so based on that initial risk assessment, we are going to define a sort of a general approach that you should take, how you should apply your test strategy to that project. And the client suggested that we use metals here. So what you see in the approach column are the periodic table symbols for different metals. So PL is platinum, AU is gold, AG is silver, PB is lead, and HG is mercury. And so what we said, if we look at the top row there that corresponds to the platinum approach, we said there's a generic test process, a general test process described in the strategy. And there's a level of rigor associated with unit testing described in the strategy. And there's a level of rigor associated with how code reviews and user story reviews, user story refinement, so forth, are all to be carried out. Those are defined in the test strategy. So there is to be no variance in terms of that process prior to starting the system test. Okay, so all the upstream activities are to be carried out in a very rigorous fashion. And then during the system testing, for anything that's considered to be mission critical, we will do extensive testing. Anything that's non-mission critical, we will do broad testing, and we will automate regression tests wherever possible. Exit criteria or definition of done will be formulated so that we have a high level of coverage, a high level of confidence, and we've assured a high level of quality. And the residual risk, this point at the end of system testing, should be low to very low. So hopefully you all follow that. Now, the next level down there, something that's been determined to be a high but not a very high risk in this pre, you know, the release planning risk assessment, the decision was this is high risk. We do allow for some amount of variance in terms of the level of rigor from a process point of view, unit test point of view, review point of view. And notice if you look at the coverage and risk mitigation column, we're relaxing our general coverage criteria here. We're saying, yeah, for the mission critical stuff, the MC stuff, we're going to test that broad. We're not going to be extensive. For the non-mission critical stuff, you know, we're going to do cursory testing, but, you know, that's it. For the regression testing, we're going to focus on manual tests. We'll get good coverage, good confidence, good quality, but, you know, not high, okay? Notice that we still end up with a low to very low residual risk because, you know, we've relaxed just enough. And so on down the line, you know, medium initial risk, we have the silver approach, which allows more latitude. The low initial risk, we have the lead approach, which allows considerable latitude. So it's basically, you know, development team, do whatever you think you need to do, and then just give it to us, and we'll do a little opportunistic testing on stuff, and then out it goes, because it's not very high risk. And then the very low mercury, well, we don't test it, right? Because, you know, mercury, it's liquid, it just runs right through. So anyway, so that was the model that we came up with. Now, one of the things that happened in this organization is that they would have situations where stuff was under some pretty significant time constraints and sometimes budget constraints. Usually it was more of a time issue because they were in a consumer entertainment space, and they had projects that were associated with particular events that were going to occur. So what we had to do is have a way of saying to the client, look, or to the stakeholders, excuse me, business stakeholders especially, look, if you are going to pressure us and pressurize the development teams into being less rigorous and us into doing less testing, we can use a lower than recommended strategy or approach, but you're going to have to accept a higher level of residual risk. So that's what this table shows here. So let's say that the initial risk is assessed to be very high, but senior management says, look, we don't have time for the platinum approach that you're recommending. We only have time for the silver approach. And then you would say, the test manager or director of testing would say, well, if we do that, that's fine, but understand that there's a high to medium residual risk of failures in production if you do that. So this is basically a way of putting that in front of management, one table, say, look, you know, if you're willing to accept the increased level of risk, this is what's going to happen. So that turned out to be very valuable to them, the ability to communicate that effectively. Okay, so we had the policy, the why, strategy, the general how to test, and then the plan is, you know, on this specific release, this is how we're going to implement the strategy. Now, this should, as I mentioned from the outset, but policies, strategies, and plans should also all be aids to getting you to think through challenges that are going to occur and figure out solutions to them before they erupt as some kind of panic. And also to be able to communicate to the appropriate people about what is being done and why it's being done. Now, in some cases, you may want to have multiple test plans if you're addressing different audiences, like if you've got a hardware element and a software element. Pretty typical to have a hardware and a software test plan. You got different levels of testing. It's pretty typical to have different test plans for the different levels, acceptance test versus system test, say. You have a risk, though, if you have multiple test plans, that they're not going to be coordinated, and you'll get people pulling in different directions. I have a client that they have like 7 or 8 different levels of testing that happen before they ultimately have software set up in their customers' data centers and doing stuff for their customers who are investment bankers. And I talked to the CEO once and asked him, you know, what is your main pain point, your main point of frustration with software testing? And he said, the main problem I have is that we have all these different groups that are doing it, and they all have their own plans and they're doing their own thing. If I go to those people and I ask, well, what's being tested, I get all these different stories. And when my customers ask me, well, how can I have confidence that that this software is going to work properly? What did you test? He said, I don't have any sort of unified view. So if you're going to have different groups that are responsible for different areas of testing and they've got their own plans, having some way of coordinating across those is definitely a good practice. And that's the ISTQB name for that anyway, is Master Test Plan. You can call it whatever you want, but making sure that there is some coordination. And that coordination can happen at the strategy level too, or even at the policy level, as we saw. Just make sure that you do have the coordination. Now, planning is something that should be thought of as I said, as communication. So you want to make sure that as you're putting your plans together, you are circulating drafts and getting some discussion going, identifying misunderstandings that might exist, so forth. Now, in terms of what goes into the test plan, well, implementation of the strategy. So what, as an example of that, let's say that in your test strategy, you talk about doing risk-based testing and you say, okay, well, the beginning of each iteration, the development team, including the tester, will sit down, they'll go through the user stories that have been selected for that iteration, and they will do a risk analysis for those user stories, and then they'll come up with a list of risks and their associated likelihoods and impacts, and thus the risk priority number for those risks, and then they'll make sure that they estimate effort and test accordingly. So that's a general statement about how risk-based testing is going to be done on a particular, iteration, but it doesn't say, you know, specifically how it's going to happen. So during release planning, when you're writing the test plan, you might add some detail in there about who are to be the participants in the risk analysis, how that gets fit specifically into the schedule, the cadence of the iteration, and so forth. Identifying what's in scope and what's out of scope, that may happen at the strategy level, or it might have to be something that's done on a project-by-project basis, release-by-release basis. Sort of the patterns of how test execution gets carried out, how does software get handed over to be tested, and then what tests get run. This can be especially critical in agile projects, and what that pattern looks like to make sure that you don't lose any time because you of course don't have any time to spare. You want to avoid situations where stuff is dropping in to the team or dropping to the tester embedded within a team, depending on how you're approaching it, you know, within 1 or 2 days of an iteration ending, because that's a great way to have some showstopper bug pop up and create a big scramble. I just saw that for a client earlier this year. Your definitions of done, your definitions of ready, if you're in Agile, should be in the test plan, unless they're generic enough to be in the strategy. Entry, exit criteria, suspension, resumption, or continuation criteria. If you're using those phrases, that would be the equivalent type of thing. How you're going to deal with test-related project risks that are specific to this release. How you make decisions about when testing needs to be halted, those sort of things. Now, one thing that I've done in test plans where there was a lot of coordination going on is to show things with pictures And so this is an example from a test plan where we have work going on in Taiwan on the left, California in the middle, and Utah on the right. And what you see is the flow of various kinds of work products between different groups. When you have work that's split up across a lot of different groups, you do have risk of miscommunication and missed handoffs. So that's something that that you might consider doing. This, of course, could be documented in a table, but I think a picture can be a little bit more compelling. Now, of course, if it gets more complicated than this, and you've got, you know, a lot more circles representing the groups and arrows representing the work product flows, then you might have to go with a table because it's just too ugly. This is a similar kind of picture that shows work products flowing between different entities, groups within the project team. So this is another way of like showing how things get handed off. Because again, my point here being that handoffs are common places where breakdowns occur, and so you know, be careful with making sure that you identify that. Now, again, this stuff, if this is general, not specific to a particular project or release, but is true generally, then, you know, feel free to kick this up into your strategy. Basically, anything that's going to be the same from one release or one project to the next, ideally is going to be in the strategy rather than the plan. Now, definitely a key thing to work out, either in your strategy or your plan, again, depends on whether this is release slash project specific or not, is this issue of how software gets delivered for testing. Now, some of my clients have this really nailed down quite well, and they've got these delivery pipelines, continuous integration systems where they're, you know, able to chunk out new releases, you know, hourly, and if not more frequently, and the process is pretty well automated. But even with some of those situations, I've seen scenarios where software got put into a test environment and testers were running tests on the test environment. They didn't know that the software had been put in, and it invalidated the results of their tests, and they had to start over. So, you know, that's not good. Anything that reduces your test efficiency is, of course, to be avoided. That said, you know, these kinds of continuous integration or delivery pipelines and so forth can be an aid when used properly. It's certainly better than, you know, some sort of manual or partially manual process, which that always really worries me when I have a client describing a process that involves a lot of manual intervention, because that's, you know, very error prone and difficult to repeat. But we want to look at things like, okay, how frequently do we get releases? How do they get installed? If a bad build gets pushed into an environment, how do we get it out? Virtualization can be helpful with that. How are the builds named, or are the revision levels assigned? How do we figure out what the revision level is? How do we ask the software, what version are you? This is really important, of course, because you want to record what version of the software you tested when you run your tests. And of course, if you find a defect, you want to record that as well. If you're doing system of systems types of tests, where there are multiple systems changing at the same time, or there's an underlying database that might be changing, make sure that you address synchronization there. I've seen situations where that got really out of hand and systems were being changed without concern or thought about how that change was going to affect other systems. And we're trying to do a system integration test, and it was a big old mess. And of course, who owns what, the roles and responsibilities. You want to make sure that it's really clear. Here again, these automated frameworks, automated delivery pipelines can be very helpful because they there's not a whole lot to do that's manual. But to the extent that somebody's responsible for something or somebody's responsible for fixing something, if it breaks, you want to know that because, you know, stuff will break. So whether in the strategy or in the plan, make sure that you've addressed this. If you can't get it, you can't test it, right? I mean, if you can't get a software release, you won't be able to run tests against it. So it's as simple as that. So this is certainly critical. Another thing, very important, managing test-related project risks. It may be possible to do some of this at the strategy level rather than at the plan level. Kind of depends on common risks that recur from one release to the next and one project to the next. You're probably going to have a mix, some sort of general test-related risk management steps that you take all the time, so they're in the strategy, whereas others may be specific to a particular release or project. Now, keep in mind, any risk, there are basically four things you can do. You can take preventive actions, try to mitigate the risk, reduce the likelihood of the risk becoming an outcome, and potentially reduce the impact if the risk does become an outcome. You can also create a contingency plan, which is something that you'll do to try to contain the impact if the risk does become an outcome. In that case, you need to have what's called a trigger, how to recognize that you need to put the contingency plan into action, and also an owner who's responsible for executing on the contingency plan. Those will be important, because if you don't have them, then it won't happen. Now, another thing that you can do is transfer risk. In other words, take a test-related project risk and make it somebody else's problem. I'm not a huge fan of this just because there is no transference without the other party accepting the risk. And my experience with that has not been all that great. People will say theoretically that they'll accept the consequences of some risk occurring, but then they actually don't. So, and the classic example of this is to say that, well, you know, we need 4 days to test feature X. And so, you know, that feature has to be delivered to us 4 days prior to the end of the iteration, or else it has to be slipped to the next iteration. And you might hear people say, oh, yes, indeed, that's definitely true, you know, during iteration planning at the beginning of an iteration. But then, you know, come the day when you say, well, all right, so, you know, that feature that we need 4 days to test, we haven't gotten it yet, and there's only 3 days left in the iteration, so that feature's going into the next iteration. And then people are running around going, oh, no, the world will fall off of its axis and roll like a marble into the sun, and, you know, all the demons of hell will come bursting out and devour everybody's flesh if we don't release this feature in this iteration. So you're just going to test it tomorrow. And then, of course, you find problems and it's a nightmare. So, you know, what I would encourage you to do, rather than setting yourself up for those kinds of unpleasant situations, just be ready to mitigate and or have a contingency plan in place. Transferring sounds great, but, you know, it often doesn't work. And then, of course, for most risks, you're just going to ignore or accept them. I mean, there's all sorts of things that could happen. I mean, you know, right now at this very moment, there could be a huge asteroid headed towards the Earth. You know, there's nothing much any of us can do about it. So we do this all the time, or the things that are of relatively low likelihood, or low impact, or particularly both, you know, don't spend time on those, because this trying to manage all the test related project risks can turn into a real time consuming activity. You get caught up worrying about stuff that's just never going to happen. Meanwhile, you're not paying attention to things that definitely are going to happen. Now, another thing that I'll point out is, you know, any particular option can provide benefits and opportunities, but it also can come with costs, of course, and can create additional risks. And I've seen situations where people triggered contingency plans that I guess they thought were a good idea when they came up with them, but definitely made things worse. So, you know, make sure that you think about the consequences of the mitigations and the contingency plans, you know, especially the contingency plans, because, as I said, it is possible that triggering a contingency plan could actually create a worse situation. Okay, so addressing life cycles and how life cycles affect what we've been talking about. I've been trying to be sensitive to the issue of life cycles as we've gone along here, but just to kind of summarize some of the key points. Certainly in your test policy, when you're putting metrics in place, you need to think about when those metrics will be gathered and how with respect to life cycle. In your strategy, is talking about how you're going to carry out your testing. So it's very much related to the larger life cycle within which it fits. So you have to be careful that the strategy is defined in such a way that it integrates testing properly into your actual life cycle. And I say actual life cycle to draw your attention to something that there are agile life cycles as they are defined in books. And there are traditional iterative life cycles like the rational unified process, or RUP, as it's defined. And there's rapid development as defined in books. And then there's descriptions of how the V model is supposed to work defined in books. Up until last week, I don't know that I had ever seen a textbook implementation of a life cycle, meaning that they did everything exactly the way it was described in the book. And this is a client that is doing a Scrum/Safe life cycle. And so I went in there expecting to see what I always see, which is that their life cycle is would be a hybrid of, you know, have some waterfallish or V model types of elements. It might have some of the more traditional RUP type of things, overlapping of iterations and so forth, and be actual agile Scrum. This really was a Scrum safe shop. I mean, they just do it exactly that way. So that was interesting to me, and just in that it's I almost never see that. Almost always what I see is that there's some elements of different life cycles kind of blended in together. Like I have a client that's in the gaming business that uses this life cycle that's sort of a blend of the spiral prototyping type of life cycles. They do a lot of early prototyping to get an idea of whether something will work. And then once they have the thing reasonably well defined, the concept reasonably well defined, then they're able to say, okay, right, now we can turn this into an epic, and we split that epic into user stories, and bam, we'll go off and build it. So that's usually what I see. So my point here is that when you're talking about how to integrate your testing into the life cycle, think about what actually goes on, not what books say goes on, and not what you think should go on, but what actually goes on. Because these documents should not be aspirational documents. These documents should be operational documents. These documents should describe the world as it is, the world in which you live, and how you deal with it effectively. Now, the policy and the strategy are going to be developed independent of a particular project, as I've mentioned. The plan, as I said, is something that is project specific. So if you're following a sequential life cycle or a V model, then the test plan and the project plan should be written pretty much at the same time. And it should define entry and exit criteria, and the test activities and the project activities should all be lined up in that document. If you're following a traditional iterative life cycle like Rational Unified Process or RUP, then the plan would be written during what's referred to as project inception and might be revised or appended at the start of each iteration. Remember, RUP style iterations are big and are months long, not like weeks. Sometimes people will ask me, really, is there still RUP out there? Well, yeah, not necessarily under that name, not that people necessarily recognize that that's what they're doing, but there are plenty of organizations that are doing it. I have one client in particular that I can think of that has these enormous releases that go on a couple years, and they're broken down into iterations, and they have, 1,000 plus people on these projects. I mean, there's a good 400 or so testers involved. And they are basically doing RUP. When they described what they were doing to me, I'm like, oh, that's RUP. They're like, you recognize it, RUP? And they're like, who's RUP? It sounds like a noise a dog makes, But it is still out there. If you're not familiar with it, go give it a read. You may find out, oh, wow, guess what? We're doing RUP. Now, in an agile life cycle, probably you're going to rely mostly on your strategy. You may have a test plan, a brief document that describes some project-specific strategy implementation details, when, those kinds of things. That would be written beginning of the release as part of release planning. Might be revised or appended at the start of an iteration, but shouldn't be really. If you're starting two-week iterations by sitting down and having to do modifications to your test plan, you're definitely doing it wrong. Your agile test plan should be written in a way that they are content independent. In other words, they're describing the process, and they're not dependent on any particular set of user stories being built. Okay, so that's what I would consider to be a quick discussion of policies, strategies, and plans. I say consider it quick in that this is something like when we do our advanced test manager course, we spend pretty much a day on this topic of going through it. But this is sort of the higher level view. Hopefully it gives you some food for thought. Just to recap, we are going to try to define what we want to accomplish and how best to accomplish it. All right, what we want to accomplish, that's it captured in the policy, and then the how we want to accomplish it, that's in a general way the strategy, and for the specific project, the plan. I mentioned alignment, making sure that you've got alignment across the document. So basically everything that's in the policy, you can point to something in the strategy that's about making that happen. Everything that's in the strategy clearly supports something that's in the policy. And when you go down to the plan level, plan is describing how the strategy will be carried out. If there needs to be deviation from the strategy for some particular reason, fine, go right ahead and do that. Document why. But it should be really clear how those things relate to each other. Now, relevance. Again, I want to come back to this. Relevance is really critical. Don't write it down if everybody knows it. Don't write it down if the stakeholder group that the document's intended for doesn't need to know it. Make sure that you're addressing this issue of relevance. And again, if you use Confluence or Wiki pages or something like that, you can keep track of, how are people actually looking at this. And that will help you, you know, check for relevance. Be concise. Less words, better than more. You know, hitting somebody with a wall of text is certainly not particularly helpful. I mean, there's this great little acronym that some of you may or may not have heard, TLDR, too long, didn't read. Keep it short. Use examples. It's okay to split it up and have it in different places. So you may have your strategy fragmented into multiple documents that talk about different topics. Again, as long as people know where to find that information. Focus on the things that are important and the things that people actually need to know. Okay, so as usual, I will put the advertisement up here. It's the end of the presentation. We'll get into Q&A. But before we get to the questions, please remember that if you feel that insights and ideas like the ones you've just heard could help with your testing challenges, please make us your preferred software testing vendor for any and all expert services, consulting, or training. Send us an email, info@rbcs-us.com. Let us know how we can help you, and we will send you a quote. So let's see. What do we got here? Questions. Andrew says, thank you. Well, you're quite welcome, Andrew. Zolt says, as mentioned, the test plan should contain what to test and what not to. What is the optimal criteria to decide on this? Some of this has to do with risk. And so your risk analysis should be helping you make this decision. Some of it has to do with just, you know, what's practical, right? You may not have the tools necessary to automate all of your regression tests or even any of your regression tests, right? So that practicality is part of it. Some of it also just relates to who's the right group or right person to own something, right? So you saw in the policy, there was that dividing up of ownership there. So, you know, those are some of the criteria that help you, like, you know, risk and constraints and optimal ownership. There can be others. Alex and Asharani both say thank you. So you're welcome. Kevin says, how are test plans practical in an Agile SDLC? Can't most of this be covered by the strategy doc? Yes. In an Agile scenario, as I think I mentioned, you really do want to get, you want to migrate as much of this stuff into a strategy. And you know, that is generally true in the sense of, when I say generally true, I mean, it's true not just of testing, it's true of development as well, that a lot of the best functioning Agile implementations that I have seen have this really super regular cadence and set of rituals and so forth. And the process is really pretty well internalized. And so, yeah, you know, there's a strategy in the ISDQB terminology, but you don't have a plan. Pardon me, I need a drink of water there. Now, that said, there may be specific things that need to be documented during release planning, as I mentioned on a previous slide, that, you know, about how the strategy is going to be implemented. So don't say, oh, because we're Agile, we don't use test plans. You know, it's more a matter of we definitely minimize the use of test plans because most stuff's in the strategy. Navya, who's left, but I'll answer her question anyway, says, can we have examples of effectiveness and efficiency testing metrics? Rather than try to give a 90-second answer to what is a really long discussion, what I would suggest is that those of you who are curious about this, go grab a copy of the Expert Test Manager syllabus. And in the Expert Test Manager syllabus, there is a discussion of metrics in Chapter 9, Sections 2 and 3. And that's got some examples. of effectiveness and efficiency metrics, and also has a good explanation of what the difference is between effectiveness and efficiency. And you, in addition to that resource, there's also like various recorded webinars that I've done, Stupid Metrics Tricks being just one of them, that relate to metrics. And so I'd refer people to that. Alex says, I always had a problem getting the email for PDU. So GoToWebinar automatically sends to every attendee an email, which we, RBCS, predefine prior to the webinar that has this information in it. So I the only thing that I can figure, if you're having a problem getting these PDU emails, is that there's some sort of spam filtering or something that's getting between you and the email that's coming out from GoToWebinar. Because it's an automated process, and it's something that it the whole thing works well enough that the process works. You know what I mean? So Alex, if you're having some specific issues, what I would recommend is that you try to address those with Citrix/GoToWebinar and see why that might be. I get you saying it's on your whitelist, Alex, but it's not something that we RBCS do, is what I'm saying. It's not like we have a little PDU elf in the back of the office who sits there and sends out emails to each attendee and doesn't like you, Alex, and isn't going to send you the emails. It's a fully automated thing being done by our vendor. So it's difficult for me to provide any insight as to why that might be breaking down. Now, Beth says, I have a registration email and one saying the webinar is starting, but it doesn't have a PDU number. That's right, Beth. You do not get a PDU number until the end. So just to recap something that I mentioned at the top, only people who attend the entire webinar get the email. That's a PMI rule. That's not something that we can do anything about. So only at the end will you guys end up getting that email. And it's also possible that if you were to drop off, and not get back on, that may create a problem. Excuse me. Let's see. Tyler says, as a new tester, creating a test strategy can be intimidating, especially as it is a dynamic document. Is there a good way to know when you are done during the initial planning? Well, I would say that if you're going to make mistakes, the mistake you want to make is under documenting, not over documenting, because then you just go back and add later when you find that you've missed something, right? But the more common mistake is that people over document. They document a bunch of stuff that isn't really relevant, and then people come to the conclusion, it's planning and strategizing and stuff's just a waste of time, and then they stop doing it entirely. So I would say start with some of the stuff where you know for sure you need to have captured, like, how is proper defect management done? What are the criteria that are used to determine priority and severity? How do you assign root causes, for example? Those sort of things. That's kind of stuff that is not immediately obvious, and people tend to not do it the same way. It's a candidate for a good place to start. Hala says, how can I select a suitable testing technique, especially if I can apply more than one on a specific case? Well, Hala, I think we're now moving beyond planning to test design. There are a number of recorded webinars on various test design techniques that are available out on our YouTube channel. So I would encourage you to go give those a listen. Anything from domain analysis to state-based testing to decision tables. Prashant says, have you come across a situation where entry criteria for test execution defined in the test plan was not met and it was still decided to go ahead with execution? Oh, yeah, all the time. Yep. Very, very common. And, you know, in that case, when you violate entry criteria or definition of ready, start testing on stuff that's maybe not really ready for testing. I think what we have to do as professional testers is just inform people that this is the risk that you're taking by doing this. And if people say, that's fine, we'll take that risk, then, you know, you need to go ahead and do what you can do. It might make sense to have that response of that's fine, we'll take that risk in writing, in an email or something, because there are certainly cases that I am aware of where it was demonstrated to my satisfaction that an organization basically threw the testers under the bus, as the cliche goes, for quality problems that were actually something that the tester kind of warned them about. But that gets us out of the realm of strategy and into politics, and so we'll stay out of there. Hollow says, is it normal to test on a production environment, or is testing on a pre-production environment enough? I hate to do this because, you know, this always strikes me as either the beginning of an endless round of bloviation when I hear it, or as a dodge. But this is one of those cases where it really does, the answer to this question really does depend on a lot of different considerations. Think about testing software that controls a nuclear reactor. Okay. Obviously you're going to do as much testing as you possibly can in simulated type of situations. That's not a production environment. And it's not a perfect replica of a production environment. So, to some extent, when that software gets released into the nuclear reactor, you know, you're testing it in a production environment. Same thing with the software that they use for the International Space Station. I mean, it's they test the heck out of it for apparently a year. But, you know, the space station is its own thing, and they've got a simulation of it, an environment that simulates it, but it's not an exact simulation. They did have a situation few years ago where they pushed an update up to the space station and it shut down the communications. The gold standard for a test environment is a complete 100% replica of your production environment. And to the extent that you move away from that, you accept risks. And so you just have to say, well, you know, what are the risks associated with each difference between the test environment and the production environment, and what do those risks mean to us? How can we mitigate them by means other than spending money on environments? How can we make sure that our testing is done in such a way that it's minimized sensitivity to that? But yeah, complicated question, and it's all the more complicated that it's associated with a boatload of money in a lot of cases. Some of our clients are really lucky, and they're operating 100% in the cloud. I say lucky, I mean lucky in terms of test environments. They're operating 100% in the cloud, and so they can just spin up a replica of their production environment immediately using their cloud service provider and then turn it off when they're done using it. But if you're not in that situation, test environments can be painful. Madhu says, thank you. Any tips to consider when creating the test strategy to overcome the scenario that the last few items to be tested in continuous integration environments ends up in system tests instead? Well, it sounds like you're saying that the automated tests that are in your delivery pipeline or CI framework are not as complete as they could be. That happens. I mean, your test strategy, again, as I said, has to be predicated on the real world in which it's going to exist. And so if you know that there are certain upstream weaknesses in the process that create or exacerbate risks from a quality point of view, you just have to be, you have to strategize accordingly. Karen said, did you mention test readiness reviews? Shouldn't this be required before testing to document new risks and document the readiness key input needed for input into testing requiring signatures for key stakeholders? I didn't mention those. In sequential life cycles, you're absolutely right, Karen. It's very common for organizations to have test readiness reviews or test level entry meetings or test phase kickoff meetings. They go by a bunch of different names, but you know, checking to see that you satisfy the entry criteria or meet the definition of ready, whatever phrase you're using. And, you know, as you said, maybe getting sign off. These are somewhat, I was going to say less common. I guess it's more a matter that these things kind of get subsumed into other sort of rituals or ceremonies that tend to be part of Agile. And so I think it's the same discussions can be happening, but they're not happening as a separate discussion. But yes, I mean, certainly evaluation of entry and exit criteria, definition of ready, definition of done. That's ideally, that's all being done explicitly, and to whatever degree there's formality associated with approving or disapproving sign offs, et cetera, that is indeed happening. So good point. Thank you for the question. All right. Well, we'll go ahead and close this session down here. Just a little bit more about resources available through RBCS, free resources. These free webinars run once a month, so check our website, rbcs-us.com, to sign up. If you want a special webinar presentation for your company only of this webinar or any other topic related to software testing, send us an email, info@rbcs-us.com, or contact us via our website. While you're at our website, you can sign up for our regular free newsletter, which will get you valuable discounts on consulting and training services, and a regular newsletter that includes a featured article on software testing and quality and news about what RBCS and its partners are doing lately. For example, in the upcoming newsletter, we're going to have an interview that was conducted of me by Agustina Gay of ISKI, where I describe all of the new and interesting stuff that has happened with the Foundation 2018 syllabus. So that's the kind of thing that's in there. You can follow us. You can see the Twitter coordinates here at RBCS and the on Facebook at Testing Improved by RBCS. Don't forget about the YouTube channel. Connect with me on LinkedIn there. You see it's Rex-Black. Send me a connection and connection request and I will accept. In terms of the YouTube channel, definitely subscribe to that. These recorded webinars are all posted out there. There's like a few hundred things. I think we're closing in on 1,000 items on that resource going back years and years. And there's just all sorts of stuff out there. So you know, take advantage of that for sure. We have one of our clients is saying that they are actually going to be posting some stuff, links to the YouTube videos on their learning management system, their in-house LMS. So get in touch with us if you want to hear about how to do that. You can also subscribe to podcast versions of this webinar. Some of these webinars are more suitable for podcasts than others. This one had some graphics in it, so it might not be a great fit, but some are good. And you know, podcasts are a great way to kind of keep up with stuff in the background. I listen to podcasts while I'm working out or doing yard work and so forth. So we offer all these free resources as a service to the software testing community because at RBCS we are a not just for profit company. But do remember that we need to keep the lights on. So Anytime you need consulting, expert services, or training related to software testing or quality, please send us an email and allow us to provide you with a quote. We don't expect to win all your business, but we'd like the opportunity to compete for all your business. This concludes the webinar. Thanks for joining us today, and see you next month.